So it is the Nailing It podcast, and this podcast is usually chatting to people from the world of business, maybe, who are doing really good things in their field, giving advice, giving a little insight into their day-to-day roles, hopefully to inspire others. As well as the business world, we just like to chat to people who are doing really well, maybe in a mission that they've took on. You know, people from Liverpool kind of have got this drive within them that when something sticks in their heads, they really want to smash it. And the person with me now is doing just that. It's a bit of a serious subject. I'm hopefully you're going to learn and take something from this. And I'm sure you've seen Laura Hughes about before. In fact, a few weeks ago, she was on every news channel going, but for all the right reasons. She's doing something called No Knife Crime, which is in memory of her brother, Colin McGinty. Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You are nailing it in what you're doing, and you've been doing it for a few years now. Yeah. And you must see now, kind of looking at what you've done over the past few years, and you must be really proud.
I am incredibly proud. What started off as just raising some money to do something positive for what would be Colin's 40th birthday has escalated on such a scale that I genuinely do feel like what we are doing, what we've done and what we are doing will save people's lives. And it literally started as we were going to do a little bit of a take part in a run, which was challenging because I'd never ever ran before. And I remember saying we were going to do a half marathon, and there was a little bit of what's a half marathon when you've got people who are doing all kinds of crazy challenges. But it really was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, even in comparison to having children. But then when we seen what we were able to raise and what we could do with that money, so like the first campaign, we funded a project with Merseyside Police. They didn't have money to do something. We were able to gift that money to the police via Cash for Kids, and we were able to do something really positive. And I was like, this has got longevity in this. And then we did something else and something else and something else, and we've got into such a good rhythm now. The campaigns evolved and shaped in a way that we know exactly what we stand for. I don't know how to articulate it really, but
you know what you are now.
Yes.
You've created something that's got a real identity.
Yes.
It's called No Knife Crime, and it's K-N-O-W.
Yeah.
Knife Crime. That's got two meanings, hasn't it?
It has. So the first is, no, don't get involved in it. Be aware of the dangers of it. And we speak a lot to children in primary and secondary schools about that. And then the other side of it is know about the long-term consequences for you, for a victim's family. You know, be aware of the laws around this. So there's no, don't do it, stay away from it, choose your friends wisely, don't put yourself in a vulnerable position, and then actually know the facts about what it's like if you got caught carrying a knife, regardless of whether you used it, what could potentially happen to you if you took a knife out. Because a big thing is you are much more likely, or a child is much more likely to have their own knife used against them if they're to take it out.
Wow.
So that's what the campaign...
That's a fact, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing that we talk to kids about is don't put yourself in a vulnerable position. When I grew up, my mum used to say, you're guilty by association. And there's actually a law which is called joint enterprise, which is a similar concept. You don't have to physically commit the crime yourself by placing yourself there. You are a part of that crime. That's like a big thing that we really talk to kids about, and about the last and long-term impact. I mean, there's something around which blows kids' heads off. If you are caught with a knife, you can't justify why you've got that knife, then you could end up having a criminal record. You could end up with a prison sentence of 4 years. I mean, there's a lot around that particular law, but I get asked all the time when I'm speaking to kids, well, what about miss if I've got cooking and I bring in my ingredients and a knife from home, and your teachers aren't going to actually ask you to bring in cooking utensils. They might ask you to bring in the ingredients, but there is no reason why you would actually be asked to bring in a knife into school when that equipment can be provided. And like the know about the consequences, I've been asked before, I get, you know, miss, well, what about if I stab someone in the arm? They're not going to die if I stab them in the arm or the leg. And it's a case of a big thing about what we say is there's actually no safe space.
Yeah.
to stab anybody.
You can still bleed to death, no matter where you get stabbed. If a knife goes through your skin, then you know you've caused lasting damage potentially, and possibly you've committed murder.
So there's a large part of what we do is we campaign, or our objective as a campaign is to be able to have knife saver bleed control kits in cabinets right across the country. Wherever you see a young person socialise or in a high footfall area, we want to have a kit and a cabinet. Exactly the same concept as the defibs. And the reason why they are so, so, so important is because it can take a person on average, and I say on average because for you it might be slightly more, might be slightly less than me, but it takes a person on average 5 minutes to lose enough blood for the heart to stop. You ring an ambulance now, a category one emergency, it can take 7 to 8 minutes for that ambulance to arrive. So when I speak to children about that, I usually then go out and say, so what would that mean to you? So if I said to you, you could lose enough blood within 5 minutes for your heart to stop. You ring an ambulance, it can take 7 to 8 minutes. What would happen to you? You're going to be dead before the ambulance actually gets to you. So the campaign, the two sides of it, the educational piece around speaking with young children, their parents, their teachers, is about making them aware of that. But then we want to have these kits in communities, so those communities are well resourced should an emergency situation happen. Because it does happen that there's something there that can actually save that person.
Think about it. If someone's ran over by a taxi on a Saturday night, they can be used for that. If someone falls on a glass, they can be used for that. Obviously, knife crime, it's a big, big thing that we've got to tackle right now. But they are a necessity now, aren't they, these?
They are, but the knife saver bleed control kits are a bleed control kit. So I'll give you an example. I've got a 16-year-old, nearly 17-year-old, on his bike, did a wheelie, fell off, cut himself terribly. That would, the ingredients in that, the products in that kit would stop him from losing too much blood.
Yeah.
They can be used in car accidents. And so I've got one in my car. They don't need to be an essential part of your everyday first aid kit, but because I'm pre-exposed to loads of information, I feel like I need one, because I know that there's the potential danger that it can happen. And here's the thing, knife crime, when Colin died, I don't want to say it didn't exist, because clearly it did, because Colin was a victim of knife crime, but it wasn't what it is now. And I've just said I've got a 16-year-old, he's 17 in 2 weeks, and I'm absolutely terrified for him. Really sensible, doesn't drink. And I said to him, because some of his mates do, and I'm like, I'm glad that you don't, but what's the reason behind that? And his words were, you don't know who you're standing next to.
Do you think he has learnt a lot from you, and he's more aware because of the fact that you're his mum?
100%.
That's a good thing, though.
It is, but I've, as an adult, definitely got post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
And it's come out now as my child is, I'm losing control. He's not in bed at 8 o'clock with a story. He's wanting to, you know, go out with his friends. I mean, this is a big thing at the moment because he's 17 in 2 weeks. He's the youngest in the year. One of his best friends is turning 18 in September. They've all just passed the driving test. They've got cars. They're wanting to go out driving. And I'm like, oh, you know, that's before he's even started going out into town and all that. So I just hope and pray that everything that I've said to him sticks in his brain.
You've just got to put your complete trust. And there's many people listening now who are in the same position as you, mums, dads, uncles, brothers, whatever they might be, who look down, they're worried all the time, and they're feeling the same as you.
Yeah.
It's a natural thing, isn't it? Listen, we're going to talk about Colin and get the story from 2001 onwards in just a little second. You mentioned something before about in 2001 when Colin was killed, knife crime wasn't such a big thing as what it is now. Does that frustrate you now when you look and you think, my God, what have we learned? You know, now it has got worse. Figures are much higher in terms of deaths through knife crime right across the world. Does that really get to you?
Yes. It absolutely boils my blood.
Yeah.
Because I get sent every day from different people within our campaign team stories all around the world, the UK, of things that have happened. And what I say is a direct result of what I see. and knife crime victims are getting younger. The stories for me are getting more horrific. But what is the most devastating is at the time we all go, oh my God, that's awful, that's terrible. And we sit with it for a minute and then we move on. You know, where I live in a lovely part of the city. I'm not saying that there's not lovely parts of the city, but I live in an affluent part of the city, right on the beach. And there was a terrible incident on Formby Beach. Two lads. So it doesn't discriminate against social demographics. You know, it doesn't, it's this kind of person that this...
Yeah, it could be anyone, anywhere,
and that's anytime. What's scary.
Yeah.
Because at the time when Colin was murdered, to set the scene, we're a normal working family, lived in Blundell Sands in Crosby. Mum and dad worked. Our Colin was an apprentice joiner based at the Royal Hospital, working on, doing an apprenticeship there. He was not associated to any antisocial behaviour, any criminal activity, you know, none whatsoever. So for us as a family, it was such a huge shock because it was like, I don't even know how to put it into context. It was that kind of situation had never appeared in any of our circles. Do you know what I mean when I say that? It was like, what the hell? And I remember my mum and dad telling me, well, my mum told me, and it just, even now, I think it's so hard to comprehend what actually happened and then the direction that our lives then took forever. And the frustrating thing for me is I think it's actually got out of hand.
Yeah.
Now, I'm confident to say that there'll be places where people have got knives on them. They just haven't been caught or they haven't done anything with it. But there's the intent to do something or to make themselves feel protected. And I know that. And again, where I live, a nice area, nice wine bars. I know there's been trouble in those in a blooming wine bar in a nice area. So it's happening. And you don't know who you're standing next to. And you don't know what confrontation can occur. So like a message that I send to my eldest son, to my nieces in uni here. If there is trouble, get out the way from it. Even if you think you are completely in the right, you get yourself out of that situation as quick as you can, because it's scary. And I think people aren't, I don't think they're as bothered about the consequences until the consequences hit them in the face.
Tell us about the consequences for you and your family. Obviously, Colin was your brother.
Yeah.
You were a lot younger. It was 23 years ago.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened, Laura. I know this is tough, but this kind of started this campaign for you. And I can't imagine, I've worked with you in the past, and I can't imagine how you've got out of bed, how you've gone to work and become very successful at work, as well as, I've got to say, become a mum, become a great wife. I just can't
fathom it. That.
But great you wife. Have. Don't tell Terry that. tell me how you do that, and tell me where all that started in 2001.
So when Colin was murdered, it was just, I don't even know how to articulate, it was the worst, weirdest, horrendous day ever. And it was a Thursday night, and our Colin was going out to Sullivan's in Bootle. Sully's,
as we all know it.
Which is where I used to go. Used to go to Yatesy's. I think I was dead posh getting a bottle of wine in Yatesy's. Then to the Merton, then to Sully's. And I didn't go that night. For whatever reason, I didn't go.
How old were you?
18.
So you're 18, and how old's Colin?
21.
Okay.
So he went to Sully's, he left Sully's, and he was on his way home with his mates, and he was walking down Marsh Lane. Now, that's a little bit away from Sully's, but he had a girlfriend who lived off Marsh Lane. At the time, my boyfriend lived off Marsh Lane, and he was one of our Collins' best mates. And there was a Volkswagen Golf, I think it was a Volkswagen Golf, pulled up, and four fellas got out of the car, and Colin and his three mates separated, went different ways, or Colin, for whatever reason, ran behind the back of the Salisbury pub. I don't know if you know Marsh Lane at all, but there's a pub there called the Salisbury pub. And he ran behind the pub to jump over the railings, and they all followed Colin and just literally attacked him beyond belief. I mean, I could
with knives.
Two knives. Yeah, every major organ, I think, apart from his heart, was injured. How he didn't die on the spot, I mean, he was, is beyond me. And I don't often talk about this because we look forward, not backwards, but I know that I have to talk about this so that people understand the severity. But if I forget why I'm saying that, come back to, just remind me, severity. Okay. So Colin's injuries were horrific, absolutely horrific, but he did get into hospital. And he got into hospital because there was witnesses, quite a few witnesses. There was so many witnesses in our Collins case. People had to get new identities, etc. Rehomed because of witness intimidation, you know. But anyway, there was somebody who was in the army who'd also been in the pub that night and had seen what happened and performed life-saving, well, it wasn't life-saving, but emergency first aid on Colin so that he was able to get into an ambulance. And when he got into hospital, my mum and dad got a phone call. But this is bizarre as well, because my mum, if my mum was telling you, she didn't ask what hospital. They just went to Fazakerley Hospital, Aintree Hospital Trust. She said every light was on green. And she said, and when she pulled up, she said that it was just carnage, blood everywhere. And she said she knew, and they got put into a side room and they knew it was Colin. She said she just knew, and then she went to see him. But obviously he's in and out of consciousness. And my mum says she'll, it was horrific. She wanted to faint. As you probably can imagine, it would have been traumatic to see. Now, we never got told. And for a very long time, I was so angry with my dad, because the hospital actually said, you can ring your loved ones. They knew. Yeah. He was going into theatre to try and have the internal bleeding stop him, but they knew that it was going to be slim.
Imagine what your dad must have been feeling there. He's, you know,
my dad was in denial.
Yeah,
my dad's a little bit like that in general.
He's wanting to protect you as
But I get it now. But for a very, very, very long time, I felt like he made that decision and shouldn't have, because we could have got to say goodbye. Because what actually happened then? So Colin dying was horrific. The aftermath. Actually, so the consequences post that are just horrendous. I mean, horrendous. My mum and dad come home early hours, that might have been 6 o'clock in the morning. I remember it so well because I had a radio alarm clock. Do you remember radio alarm clocks?
Yeah.
With the CD on the top. And the radio alarm clock went off. I got in the shower. And I looked, I had a funny feeling when I woke up, and I didn't know what it was, but I had a funny feeling. Looked out the window, and my mum and dad's car wasn't there, and I just thought maybe something had happened with my granddad. Just, there was nothing wrong with my granddad, but I just had this weird thought, because my mum and dad's car wasn't there at like 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And then I got out the shower, and my mum and dad came in, and my mum was like screaming, and it was just a horror movie kind of moment, because she said Colin's died, he's been murdered. And I was like, I mean, I won't swear, but it was like a what the,
it didn't hit you.
No,
you couldn't understand it.
No.
Yeah.
And then I've got twin brothers, so they were upstairs in bed. See, the where it was, you'd come upstairs, and that was like the first floor, and that was my bedroom, the living room, the kitchen, and then up was my mum and dad's bedroom, Colin's bedroom, and the twins' bedroom. And I've got an older brother, but he was in Leeds University. So I went and woke the twins up to tell the twins, who were 12 months younger than me, and they were exactly the same as me, like, what?
I suppose you get told your brother, your brother who's only 21 has died. That's the first knock. But then being told someone that you deeply love has been murdered, that must be a massive, I couldn't comprehend that.
It's like a horror movie. Even now when I think about it, your body just goes into complete and utter shock. Complete and utter shock. Because that's what I couldn't understand it. Now, I was very much, and I was like this at court, at the trial, and actually after the trial, which I'll tell you about in a second, but I wanted to see Colin because I didn't believe it. And my dad, again, was like, you don't, and you're not. And I was like, no, I am. I'm very headstrong. And I said to our family liaison officer, so the police give you a family liaison officer who they report on what they can within the case. They're your go-to for everything to do with what's happening. And his name was Keith, and I said, I need to see our Colin. So we were able to go, but mum and dad didn't go. I think our Roberts, I can't even remember now who it was that took us. In fact, my dad did go. My dad come. But we went into, it was a bit like, it reminded me, have you ever been to Butlins?
Yeah.
So it was the morgue, or the chapel arrest, not the morgue, it's not the morgue, it's the chapel arrest. It was like a chalet. So you have like a little room that you go in, and then there's like a door like that and glass, and then you go into the other room. But before we went, there's a reason I'm saying this, because before we went in, the police said to us, look, I know this is terrible, but you aren't allowed to touch him. You're not allowed to go anywhere near him. You can't breathe near him. You can't do this. And they literally keep you like this because he's classed as evidence. And I was like, oh my God. The rage I felt was uncontrollable. I don't mean like upset. I think that's probably up there as
well. Angry.
I was fuming. Yeah. I was. And I looked at him in the bed, and I was convinced he was breathing. Because, you know, if you look at something, like, you look at something for long enough, you see it moving, don't you? And I remember coming home and just being like, wow, what is happening? And that was just the starters of it. Because there was no motive for Colin's murder. The police don't know that. They don't know him. He wasn't known to the police.
At the time, there was so much unknown.
Yeah.
It must have been so much unknown for you.
And my mum and dad are like, who's confusion his friends? Who's his girlfriend? What has he got a double life? Because there is negative stigma around murder. Sometimes the victim's known, the person that's committed the crime knows the victim. You know, there's a saying, isn't there? There's no smoke without fire.
Yeah. And even you, as Colin's sister, Colin's mum is close, must have all been, you must have had that cloud over you thinking, what's happened? Has he done something wrong? Has he?
Yeah. It was like, what life did he lead that we don't know about here? We had no motive. So the police then obviously have to come to our house. They have to go through all Colin's belongings, take away things that, which I get, I completely understand, but that's awful as well, because that's like shrouded with like what if, or thinking about all these scenarios of why has this actually happened. Anyway, that went on for, I don't even know the timeline, to be honest with you, days, a week, until they caught them. And the police knew they had an idea, but they can't give us that information. So that, again, that's like the kind of person I am. If you said, can I speak to you later, I'd be like, no, I need to know what you want to be talking about now. Yeah. I can't.
Yeah.
You cannot drip feed. Yeah.
Especially with someone like this, Laura, you need to know.
Well, I've later learned that that's actually a trait of ADHD, which I am 100% riddled with, right? But you cannot drip feed information to me. And sometimes that's what the police sort of do, because they have to give you something so we have confidence in them. And my God, do we have confidence in them? We are so lucky to have a police force like Merseyside Police. We are so incredibly lucky. And anyone who says different about the police, I'd go toe-to-toe with them every single day just because of how incredible they are.
I think just from seeing what I see in the media world, how active they are in terms of trying to put messages out. And we are very lucky to have Merseyside Police. Tell us what happened after this then, because they've now caught the killers.
Well, they caught two of them. There was four. Two had an alibi. Two of them's alibi didn't stack up. And they actually caught them on the way to sell the car that they were in that night at the auctions. So the police were able to piece the crime together pretty well. So we knew, they came to us to say that they've got two in custody. And it's a race against time then to actually charge them. You've only got so many hours. So again, that was like a, oh my God, like, are these the right people? What can you tell us? How do you know that they're the right people? What? And they couldn't give you so much information because you can't, like, the media can't know, or until it then goes to court. So they got charged with murder, pending a trial, because they pleaded not guilty. It went to a trial, and the trial was in October. So Colin died 23rd of March, and I remember the trial being in October, because I just started a new job in recruitment, and I had said to my boss, I'm going to need some time off. I'll take it as holidays or whatever, but I need, it might have been better in hindsight to start after the trial, really, but the trial, which happened in October, was up there as one of the most stressful, worst experiences of my life. And I think if I had to go through that now, I'd have to. But I think back and think, how the hell did we do that?
It's something that you don't realise, isn't it? You kind of see these trials on TV, or we read about them in the news. You don't actually look and see what that's doing to a family and what the pain that they've got to go through to get through a trial like that, to get justice in the end, hopefully. You don't realise what that takes and what that takes out of a human, do you?
It's crazy because you're sitting right next to the people, literally as close as this, their families, 18 movie when you're 12 that you know you shouldn't watch, yeah. But you're there because you've got to watch it, because you can't not watch it. It was surreal because we got two squired in juries, so we had a jury and the case started, and it might have been, again, my mum would know this off the top of her head, but it might have been a week into the trial, and we found out that one person on the jury was mates with
the suspect.
Yes, I couldn't think, the suspects.
Wow.
So that's threw everything off.
So that's full on, that's more pain in itself, isn't it?
And then we had to have a new jury squired in, or whatever the saying is. As the case continued, one of the jury members was poorly and couldn't return, but we were too far gone. So it was decided that we were going to carry out this was the maddest thing about it. It wasn't the McGinty family taking these to court. It was the Crown taking these to court. That was a hard thing to get my head around, because Colin was dead. It's the Crown. It's the Queen.
Yeah.
And Colin isn't a person. He's a thing. This is something that happened to him, but it's actually the Crown Prosecution Service that are taking these to court, because this is wrong what they've done. So that was quite a mad, you don't have any say in it. You can't comment on it. You're prepped to an inch of your life of how to behave in court. Like we were told, don't look at the jury, don't shout out, don't do this, head down. And that's hard. That's hard when they then take the stand, or their families take the stand. And but the jury ended up lasting. They didn't get a new jury, and they had a unanimous verdict against both of them on every count, which shows that the case the police had built was
right,
was incredible.
Tell me why they killed Colin.
So again, this is a mad one. I don't often talk about this as well, because it's not in context to anything really, but we still never had no motive for Colin's murder. None. Just wrong place at the wrong time. Years and years and years later, I'm talking, I don't even know, maybe 10 years later. So a long time.
Yeah.
We were getting on with our lives more then. The police come to my mum and dad's, and they said that there was a drugs raid done on a house in Walton, and the person who had this apartment or this house in Walton was friends with somebody who was sharing a prison cell with one of them. And so this drug trade was done on a house in Walton. The person who lived in that house in Walton had a mate in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having communication back and forth in the form of letters. And this person who was in prison was sharing a cell with one of these.
With one of Colin's killers.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they were describing who they were in the prison cell with. And they said, I'm in a cell with somebody who killed that lad from Crosby, thinking he was, and said who they thought he was. And I won't say it now.
Yeah.
Because...
So, mistaken identity.
Yes. And they said who they thought he was. So, yeah. We were like, oh my God. I didn't even know what the underworld was. By the way, I thought it was Blum and, what's his name from Corrie, who's got the factory.
Yeah.
Mike Baldwin. Honestly, it was an education for us. When the police start using all these terms, I was like, well, what does that mean? What does that mean?
But why would you know? Why would your mum know? Why would your brothers know? You're a normal, good family, yeah, trying to get on with your lives. Why would you know this stuff?
But then we moved, right? And this is the, you know, where things happen and you think, that's weird. We moved to Formby, and my mum and dad's window cleaner knocked on my mum and dad's one day and said, I'm reading a book and it's got your son in it. And my dad was like, what? This book has been written by an ex-gangster gone good and talks about all the underworld, all the, you know, the baddies basically from Liverpool, and it specifically references what happened to our Colin, thinking he was somebody else.
Wow.
And I was like, is there a higher being that play here showing us these things? Because we needed some kind of, it's okay to get justice, and it is justice in one respect because there's somebody serving time, but there's no reason. There was still that, like, well,
that
why?
Must be the most painful thing.
It's frustrating.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating because it's like, why? Like,
losing anyone to anything, whether it's a heart attack, a car accident, whatever it might be, is absolutely tragic and hard enough. I think to lose for murder, you tell me, it must be the biggest head wobble you could ever imagine, because it is that question, why? That didn't have to happen. Do you go through that still? Do you?
Yeah, because it was a waste.
A waste, yeah.
And I don't know a better word. Waste, yeah, doesn't do it justice. He died for no... He literally died to be mistaken for somebody else, because he does look a little bit like him.
Mm.
But the reality is, he isn't him. He's a lad from Crosby who, yeah, had a job. He didn't... He, you know, and that's... Would it be an easier pill to swallow? Don't know.
Yeah.
Probably, because you'd go, well, you wouldn't go, well, but you'd go... It's happened because of, you know. And the thing is, there's a bigger picture here, because at court, when the verdict is read out, this is the most frustrating thing. And this is a big thing that we've campaigned against as a family for a very long time, up until No Knife Crime was born, is the justice system. Because the people that killed Colin were well known to the police. They had a criminal record as long as their arm. They'd been up for attempted murder that they got away with. They had literally, you know, so how on earth did it even get to that stage? How were they out roaming the streets? And the reality is, they've served their life sentence in prison, which was, for one, 17 years, come straight out, recommitted a crime, not murder, very, 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 very severe, which has warranted them going back in for another life sentence. And I think about that, I have a very different opinion on this to my mum and dad, because Colin was my brother, not my son. But what a waste of a life that is. He was 23, I think, when he went to prison. Not being able to have kids, holidays, life. Life in prison, basically. What an absolute waste. And then I've like gone, well, what, where were they before they got to that stage? What happened to them to make them go that way? And we're not all born bad. We're not. I don't think, anyway. I don't think we're all born bad. They've been dealt a different set of cards, and they've chose wrong. They've made really wrong life choices that's impacted them, their families, for the whole time that they're on this world, which is why. So, you know, I said about severity before. What happened to our Colin was extreme. What's happening now, it is extreme, but it can be kids dying from a single stab wound. It doesn't have to be that stab 17 times.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to have all that drama around it. You get what I'm saying? It's two mates who've had a fight that's got out of hand. He didn't mean to kill him, but he's killed him because he's lost too much blood, you know. So
what you're saying is it's Colin's case. It's just listening to that full story, Laura, and I've known you for many years, is horrific.
Yeah.
Colin's case was horrific.
Yeah.
You know, any murder is horrific, of course. But what you're saying is that you can literally be walking down the street, knock into someone.
Yes.
They stab you once, you're dead. That's it.
And that, for me, frightens the living daylights out of me.
We've got to talk about what you're doing. Because
yes,
as much as we say, and you know, it is a horrendous story that you've just shared, but it's a really important story, because what you're doing is saving lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got to always remember that. I don't know some days how you do find the strength to get out of bed. I don't know how you got past through the past 20 years. But what you're doing now must make you feel a little bit easier.
It makes me feel like, and again, I have a different opinion than my mum and dad. I'm trying to get my mum and dad more involved with this work.
Mm.
Because it makes me internally rationalise and think he didn't necessarily die in vain. Because I think about the young lads specifically that I go to speak to who are in junior school. And I like working with kids in junior school more than I do in seniors, because in juniors they are little sponges. They haven't got that or feel ashamed to ask that question, or and they listen. And their friendships before they get to seniors aren't fully formed. Do you know, they're not, oh, I've got to follow what that kid's doing because otherwise, you know, I'm not going to have any mates for the rest of my senior school life. But I think about, how does it go wrong for somebody to commit that crime?
Mm.
And a lot of the time, it's because they're groomed. And we associate grooming to, like, from a sexualized thing, from a religion thing. It's not. It's people who exploit other people's weaknesses and show them a different style of life and security, and they feel like they need to do those things that are asked upon them, which make terrible, terrible life choices and massive, massive consequences. So I want to work with children so that I can share a bit of Colin's story. And I say a bit of Colin's story because I never talk about the case, or, you know, we show a video, but we don't tend to look backwards, we always look forward.
Yeah.
But we have to tell a bit of the story. Because I then say to kids about making the right choices, and I say, you know, choose your mates wisely. If there's a fight, don't be there. Don't film it. Don't share it. Because you're putting yourself, you might as well be the one fighting. You're putting yourself in that situation. Someone asks you to mind a knife, don't, because you are likely to get stopped. You're also likely to have that used against you. You know, so I do that, and that makes me feel better, because I the more the kids ask me questions, and I'll give you an example of that, the stuff that we've just done with the Sefton schools, I have been asked the most brutal questions. I'm prepared for it now, but I wasn't with the first school.
This is little kids, this is young
kids. You're talking
kids.
Year four, year five, yeah. And six. And one,
I suppose,
kid,
that's just their brains, isn't it?
Which,
yeah,
is brilliant,
yeah.
Right? I could see the teacher panicking. Because I was like, I had to say, let me just think about how I'm going to answer this properly. Just give me a minute. I mean, one kid asked me how long did it take for him to die? What were his last words? Did they get him? Did you get him?
But that's their little brains trying to comprehend,
yeah,
what you're telling them, isn't it? And I suppose, as you say, that sponge thing, that's a good thing, because they're thinking, their minds opening up to something that they must just not understand it.
They're just thinking.
Yeah.
They're literally just thinking and they're speaking. One kid was like, but miss, why didn't he get on his bike?
Ah.
And I was like, because Sonny didn't have his bike there, but if he had his bike there, he probably would have gone on his bike, you know. But I feel like you make a difference to those young people. I think, will they remember that conversation I've had with them when they're put in a situation, yeah, when they go to year seven? Because it changes. I've got an older kid who's now in college. Year seven, they're gorgeous. They're in the blazer. They're in all the gear, and they want to wear the shoes because the headmaster says to wear the shoes, you can't wear trainees. They get into year eight and the personality's changed. They get into year nine and they're completely different. My son went to bed Christmas Eve and come down a man on Christmas Day. Now, luckily, like, his mates are nice. But that, you know, I think they're nice. It could, you know, as he's getting older and he's making his decisions for himself, I just have to hope that I've done enough for him to make the right decisions. Not everyone's the same.
Mm.
Not everyone has that.
But as well, though, what you said before was a really good point, that this can happen to anyone, anywhere, no matter the background, no matter the mum, no matter the dad, no matter where they live. That's how...
Kids are robbing kids for the bikes.
Yeah.
At knife point. So, you know, we went through a stage of electric bikes.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing. And one, they are so much money. I was like, you're not getting a lecky bike. Who needs a lecky bike? But that was the thing. Kids were having electric bikes. When I was younger, probably when you were younger, it was a coat. I remember saving up all my Saturday job money for a Henry Lloyd. Helly Hansen, Henry Lloyd, Berghaus, it's bikes.
Yeah.
It's bikes. And how many times do I see on Facebook such a one's bike was robbed at knife point?
Yeah.
We go to a running track on a Wednesday night, and it's on a lovely wildlife kind of, I can't even think what it's called now. So kids had his bike taken off him. His trainee's taken off his feet. And he's not going to not give them to him if someone's got a knife to him. And I think, what's going on? Like,
tell me, we've got to finish up.
Sorry, I've been forever and ever, haven't I?
You've shared an incredibly powerful story that I'm hoping many people have listened to and took lots from. And I think Colin's story, you could tell that story and not do any more. And it would make an impact the way that you tell that story and deliver it. You are doing tons more, though. What do you want to see from No Knife Crime?
I want to see, wherever you see a defib cabinet, I want to see a knife savers kit in a cabinet, standard, mandatory. And we're doing that. We are making positive inroads. We have got so many exciting projects. And I think the mindset over the last few years has changed.
It's
and
flipped.
It's positive.
Yeah.
The stuff that we've just done with Sefton, all the schools in Sefton, was one of the best things I've ever been a part of.
It was a relay race, by the way. We put a video on the guide, which we'll share the link with in this podcast. It was phenomenal. And hundreds, thousands of kids got involved.
We worked with 35,000 kids that week.
Wow.
And what we're doing next year is we're doing the same, but bigger. We're working with all of Merseyside. I'm going to a Safer Schools conference in September to talk to all the teachers who have got a Safer Schools officer across Merseyside as a region. I think there's like 500 and something schools. We're going to do Merseyside schools say no knife crime and do the relay race event. But the positivity from all those Sefton schools was unbelievable. I got my mum and dad involved. I got the kids involved. For them to see, my parents to see that, I mean, it was incredible. We went to one school in Bootle, and my dad was so quiet. There was the whole of the school, nursery reception, year one, right up to year six juniors. These all made posters. They were all chanting no knife crime. They had the relay kids who came in from one school to the other. They all come in running to We Are the Champions by Queen. They had confetti cannons. It was just unbelievable. All these little kids in Colin t-shirts, you know, and I got back in the car and I said to my dad, we wanted to create a positive legacy. We've succeeded.
Absolutely.
We have succeeded. We've raised as well £28,000. That's directly going to benefit Sefton as a community. You're not going to be able to miss a knife savers kit and cabinet. So I feel like what we've set out to do, we're getting there. Just like we're taking off a borough.
I think you've surpassed what you set out to do. I think now every time you do something, then your goal changes and gets a bit bigger. I remember a few years ago when you started this, you weren't planning on doing relays for kids.
We just wanted to raise a bit of money for Colin's 40th birthday. I mean, there's something incredibly huge that's happening and I can't even really share it, but it's huge.
Well, that is for podcast number two.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for chatting to us. I know that was difficult to tell that story, but so important for anyone listening to hear that story in full. What you do at No Knife Crime is incredible. You've got so much respect in this city. Please keep going. because as you said before, if you can change the mindset of one kid, if you can save one life, it's worked, hasn't it? It's done it. What's your message, Laura, before you finish? What would you like to say to anyone listening right now?
A big message, if I was to directly talk to parents and children, to parents, drum into your kids about choosing their mates wisely. Check your kids. My kids are good. I still check them. Because situations, you know, can occur. And I would really like as much support as possible with getting involved with Knife Savers. So that, you know, if you work for a local authority and you want to get involved and you want to have a cabinet up in a public place, stand with me on it. Stand with me and Knife Savers to make it happen.
And we can donate as well, can't we? Give us this information with the website and stuff.
So if you go to the No Knife Crime website.
Yeah, which is No Knife Crime. In fact, if you just Google No Knife Crime, KNOW, it comes straight up.
And you'll be able to donate there.
Yeah. Okay. Laura Hughes, keep going. Keep doing what you're doing. And keep smashing it, because you are doing an incredible thing. Thank you so much for chatting.